From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon talks about his new detective novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. The novel is based on this premise: what if the State of Israel collapsed in 1948, and in the wake of the Holocaust, Jews were given a temporary homeland in Alaska? Also, we talk with John Savage, who's best known for chronicling the history of punk rock. His new book, Teenage, is about the creation of youth culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Chabon, won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel Cavalier and Clay, in which he imagined the lives of people working on the early superhero comics. He rewrites a different chapter of history in his new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. It's based on this premise: what if the fledgling state of Israel collapsed in 1948, and in the wake of the Holocaust, part of Alaska was set aside as a temporary refuge for Jews? The novel is set 60 years later in Alaska, when Jewish rights to this district are running out and it's about to revert to Alaskan control. The main character, Meyer Lantzman, is a homicide detective living in this temporary Jewish homeland, investigating a murder. Reviewing the Yiddish Policeman's Union in the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani wrote, "It creates a completely fictional world that is persuasively detailed, even as it gives the reader a gripping murder mystery and one of the most appealing detective heroes to come along since Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe." Here's a short reading from the beginning of the book.
The Holy Land has never seemed more remote or unattainable than it does to a Jew of Sitka. It is on the far side of the planet, a wretched place ruled by men united only in their resolve to keep out all but a worn fistful of small change Jews. For half a century, Arab strongmen and Muslim partisans, Persians and Egyptians, socialists and nationalists and monarchists, pan-Arabists and pan-Islamists, traditionalists and the party of Ali have all sunk their teeth into Eretz Yisroel and worried it down to bone and gristle. Jerusalem is a city of blood and slogans painted on the wall, severed heads on telephone poles. Observant Jews around the world have not abandoned their hope to dwell one day in the land of Zion. But Jews have been tossed out of the joint three times now, in 586 BCE, in 70 CE, and with savage finality in 1948. It's hard even for the faithful not to feel a sense of discouragement about their chances of once again getting a foot in the door.
That's Michael Chabon reading from his new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Michael, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. It's so nice to be here.
How does Sitka become an unlikely homeland for Jews after the Holocaust in your novel?
Well, in my novel, an actual proposal that was made initially by the Department of the Interior under Franklin Roosevelt to permit refugees from Europe, Jewish refugees from Europe, primarily, of course, to enter the United States on a very limited, very controlled basis and to settle temporarily, in all likelihood, in Alaska, has come to pass. So in obviously in our world that didn't happen. And in fact, there was a bill introduced into Congress. It was called the King-Havener Bill. It died in committee. It was never brought to the floor for a vote. But in the world of my novel, it actually passed. And these Jews, ultimately several million of them, were allowed to enter the United States. They thought it was going to be a temporary thing, but they ended up, the way these things tend to happen, nobody ever quite got around to figuring out what to do with them after the war was over. And they were granted a kind of semi-permanent lease. But that lease in this year, 2007, has now come due, and they all have to figure out where to go now.
And their claim on this territory is running out, so they're going to have to relocate.
Exactly. It's called reversion. the territory, this little ribbon of territory that they were permitted to settle in, which is just the western sides of Baranof and Chichagof Islands up in the southeastern panhandle part of Alaska, a region whose center is right now, in our world, is the very small city of Sitka, Alaska, which has about 9,000 people living there. In the world of the novel, that was sort of the capital city, and it's actually a big metropolis. And they've all made homes, they've made lives, industries, businesses, and everything. They actually have a whole, almost like a little micro nation that they've created. It's Yiddish speaking. But yes, now this territory is set to revert to the state of Alaska, and Alaska is going to regain control over it, and it will be incorporated into the state.
Well, tell us more about what almost happened historically, the bill that didn't pass, but that was talked about.
Well, the Interior Department under Harold Ickes proposed essentially killing two birds with one stone by exploiting the vast untold resources, the wealth of Alaska, which at this time in 1940 was very much untapped and unexploited, and this pressing, heart-wrenching problem of all of these people that were desperate to get out of Nazi-occupied Europe. That sort of humanitarian concern was hidden within this notion that we can exploit Alaska and get a foothold there and so on. And so they proposed letting these refugees settle there, and a bill was introduced. There was very stout opposition. The native Alaskan community, the European, the American descended people living there were vehemently opposed to it. They were sort of championed by their delegate to Congress, this guy Anthony Diamond, who was also dead set against this happening, and he campaigned and ultimately was able to quash this thing before it ever even made it into a floor vote in Congress. But in my novel, this delegate Diamond is coming out of Hogate's restaurant in Washington, D.C., and which at least used to be famous for their rum buns. I don't know if they still are, if they even are still in existence, but he drops his rum bun and he's chasing it down the street, and he's run over by a taxi and killed. So with him not there to spearhead the opposition, the motion is eventually carried and this territory comes into being.
How did you even find out about this arcane bit of history?
You know, I don't even know. It's like one of those items of Jewish trivia that you pick up over the years, like, you know, that Cary Grant's mother was Jewish or something like that. I heard about it. I read about it somewhere. I've always been struck by these possible alternate Jewish homelands that have been proposed over the years. It's been proposed, you know, that Jews, at one time there was a Uganda plan that the British Empire had put forward that Jews should be allowed to settle in Uganda, Australia, Madagascar. You know, one hears, I think even Suriname, there was a brief Dutch plan to allow the Jews to come into Suriname at some point. So, those what ifs, those might have been, those maybes, those are endlessly fascinating to me. And so I think I just picked it up along the way and never forgot it.
So you've created for your novel this place in Alaska that's a kind of like temporary homeland for Jews displaced by World War II. Can you describe a little bit what this community has grown up like in your novel?
Well, it's a big city. Sitka has become a big city, tall buildings. They've filled in a lot of the harbor area. There are a lot of islands up there. It's an archipelago. And close into the city of Sitka, they've done all this landfilling so that they can have construction. And it's got everything a contemporary city, you know, is expected to have in the range, you know, from big box shopping malls to symphony orchestra and everything in between. There's a very diverse community of Jews living there. And by diverse, I mean they range from the most secular, contemporary, somewhat, deracinated, but just people who don't identify terribly strongly with the religious aspects of Judaism, all the way to ultra-Orthodox Hasidic sects and everything in between. And it's kind of a swinging place in some ways. You know, there's a lot of art and music and culture, and the Yiddish language remains in full flower. On the other hand, it's, you know, it's a dark place. It's in Alaska. It's gray. It's rainy. And there's also this constant anxiety that's been hanging over these people for 60 years that it is meant to be temporary, and it could all be ending soon. You know, in a way, that's been the facts for Jews for the past 2,000 years, in a sense, the knowledge that you, no matter how well you do in a place, no matter how greatly you prosper, your lease could be canceled at any time, at any moment, and you'll have to move on. And so in one sense, they're living with that consciousness in a way that, you know, their ancestors have been living for 1,000 years or more.
In your novel, there's an island called Verbov that is populated by ultra-Orthodox Jews who are known as Verbovers. And there's a passage I'd like you to read that's set on the island that describes the ultra-Orthodox Jews that live there. Could you just set up who we'll be hearing from in this short reading?
Yes. Meyer Lantzman, the protagonist of the novel, is a homicide detective in Sitka, and he and his partner, Berko Shemets, have drawn this case. There's a murder in the opening pages of the novel, and in pursuit of a lead they've gotten that the victim might have possibly been connected to the Verbovers in some way, they've decided to brave Verbov Island, which is this kind of almost like a, I think it's an idealized shtetl in many ways. It was created sort of out of nothing by this sect, this ultra-Orthodox sect, to recreate the world of their sect's homeland in Verbov, back in the old country, which Verbov is a small city somewhere in Eastern Europe, in Russia or Poland. My mother's maiden name was Verbo, her mother's maiden name, so I was just kind of trying to draw on my own heritage and naming it. There is no such sect, obviously. Friday afternoon on Verbov Island, and Lantzman's Chevelle Supersport surfs the wave of black hats along Avenue 225. "Look at this place," Lantzman says. "It's hopping." "Not one empty storefront," Berko says. "And more of these no-good yids than ever." Lantzman stops for a red at Northwest 28th Street. Outside a corner store by a study hall, Torah bachelors loiter, scripture grifters, unmatchable Luftmenches, and garden variety hoodlums. When they notice Lantzman's car with its reek of plainclothesman hubris and its inflammatory double S on the grill, they leave off yelling at one another and give Lantzman the Bessarabian fisheye. He is on their turf. He goes clean-shaven and does not tremble before God. He is not a Verbover Jew, and therefore is not really a Jew at all. And if he is not a Jew, then he is nothing. "Look at those bums looking," Lantzman says. "I don't like it." "Meyer." The truth is, black hat Jews make Lantzman angry, and they always have. He finds that it is a pleasurable anger, rich with layers of envy, condescension, resentment, and pity.
That's Michael Chabon reading from his new book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. What you're getting at in that reading is the division between secular Jews, like your main character, who's a homicide detective, and the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who are in this new homeland for the Jews in Alaska. But, you know, that division exists in real life.
Absolutely.
And why did you want to write about that division?
Well, it seemed to me to be an inevitable feature of any large community of Jews living all together. You know, I felt like it would be inaccurate portrayal of this place if those fissures didn't exist. And really, that my knowledge of that comes out of my knowledge of Israel, the state of Israel, in our world, my somewhat limited knowledge, but it was apparent to me on my one visit to Israel that there's so many divisions among Jews there, not just between ultra-Orthodox and secular, but between Ashkenazic and Sephardic and Russians non-Russians and so on, that it would have been inaccurate to leave that out.
My guest is Michael Chabon. His new novel is called The Yiddish Policeman's Union. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Chabon. His new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, is based on the premise, what if the State of Israel collapsed in 1948 and a district in Alaska was set aside as a temporary Jewish homeland? Why did you want to combine the fictional story you tell in the book of this alternate version of history, where a homeland for the Jews after World War II is created in Alaska, to combine that with, you know, a detective story?
Because I'm a nut. I don't know. It seemed like the right thing to do. I think there was a review in the New Yorker magazine. A few weeks ago by Clive James, where he kind of did a roundup of some detective fiction from around the world, international detectives, Michael Dibdin books, and so on. And he talks about how these detectives are all connected to the cities that they live in, whether it's Venice or Stockholm or wherever it might be. And he said in passing something like, you know, the detective novel has always been in part a guidebook. And I thought that was putting it really well. And it wasn't anything I had ever exactly thought to myself in those terms, but I think I had that sense, so that when I came up with the idea of setting a novel in this imaginary land, I realized I had this job to do of making it feel clear and plausible and articulated to the reader, so that the reader would understand the place. And in order to understand the place, the reader needed a kind of guide. And I felt, I guess just intuitively, that a policeman with his badge and therefore with his access to every level of society, no door is really closed to him, that he would be the perfect guide, that in the company of a policeman, we would be able to go everywhere and see everything. And, you know, then I love hard-boiled detective fiction. Raymond Chandler is one of my favorite writers, always has been. I love the novels of Ross Macdonald. And, you know, as soon as I started to germinate this idea, the thought, oh, I'll get to write a hard-boiled detective novel, my own version of Chandler and Macdonald, that was just immediately appealing to me.
Now, what do you like about taking history and completely rewriting it with a different premise? You did that with comic books and Cavalier and Clay. And you're doing it with a Jewish homeland in your new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
Well, actually, I think it has a lot to do with comic books in a way. When I was a young kid reading comic books, there was a sort of very popular kind of story that was being written then. It was popular starting in the 50s, and in particular in Superman comic books. That was called the imaginary story, which I kind of love that distinction being made, but imaginary Superman stories were Superman stories in which something was different than in the sort of official canonic Superman story, where he comes to Earth and crashes in outside of Smallville, you know, and the Kents rescue him from his rocket ship and they raise him, and they would do these stories, you know, what if Superman's rocket ship had landed in Africa, or what if the rocket ship from Krypton had landed in Canada. You know, and we had a Canadian Superman, what would that be like? And, or, you know, what if Lois Lane was the one who came from Krypton? And that sort of hypothetical story, the what if story, which then later also was done a lot at Marvel. And in fact, Marvel Comics had a whole series called What If, in which, you know, the Fantastic Four each had the other one's powers and so on. I think that was really my first introduction to the idea of counterfactual or hypothetical kinds of stories, the what-if story. What if this one thing had been different? And it's always a kind of story I took an interest in. There's a classic novel called Lest Darkness Fall by L. Sprague de Camp, in which the Roman Empire never fell and has survived into the modern era and so on. I was always drawn to those kinds of stories. I mean, I think anyone who lies awake at night sort of going back over the course of his or her life and asking him or herself the question, you know, how did I get here? That sort of David Byrne question, you know, what brought me to this point? You look back over your life and you see, I mean, at every moment you're making choices that determine the future course of your life, but there always do seem to be these sort of key junctures where if I had taken that job or if I had said yes to that person, if I had done this, if I had done that, my whole life would have been different. I think we have that tendency to do that with our individual histories, and then it's just a short step away to do it with history, with a capital H, and look at those sort of what seem to be juncture moments and wonder how things might have come out differently.
So if those what-if moments in comic books inspired your new novel, what was the first, like, what-if you came up with for your novel?
Well, the genesis of the novel really lay in this book, an actual book published by Dover Publications called Say It in Yiddish. And Say It in Yiddish is subtitled A Phrase Book for Travelers. And I came upon this book in a bookstore. I was entranced immediately by the idea of there being a phrase book for travelers in Yiddish that's, like any phrase book, is full of all these unintentionally droll things that you might need to say, such as, I need a tourniquet, or, you know, which way to the casino. And I was so struck by this idea of a phrase book in Yiddish with no obvious destination, that I wrote an essay that was published many years ago now where I sort of speculated on possible places that might have come into being where you could have taken this phrase book for Yiddish as you would take, say, it in French to France or say it in Swahili to Africa.
Because there is no country in which Yiddish is the national tongue.
No, I mean, and there, you know, in a sense, there was at one time. I mean, there were many millions of Yiddish speakers in Europe going up to, right, and, you know, obviously in America as well, going right up to the Second World War. But they never had, Yiddish speakers never had a country of their own, the kind of place that seemed to be implied by this phrase book that gave you phrases to use when dealing with customs officials in Yiddish and, you know, casino employees, airline employees, and so on. Like the idea of a Yiddish airline, for example, a Yiddish-speaking Jewish airline just entranced me. And so, I mean, the initial what if was not a specific forking in history so much as a what if there really were a country where everyone spoke Yiddish? What would that be like? And so that what if was presented to me by this little book, Say It in Yiddish, that I came upon so many years ago now.
Michael Chabon will be back in the second half of the show. His new novel is called The Yiddish Policeman's Union. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Growing Girls, The Mother of All Adventures, a collection of essays on motherhood by columnist Jean Marie Laskus. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation during National Foster Care Month, promoting lifelong connections for all kids in foster care at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The young ones, darling, we're the young ones.
Coming up, we talk with John Savage. He's just written a book about the creation of youth culture. He's best known for chronicling the history of punk rock. And we continue our interview with Michael Chabon about his new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
Song to be sung, and the best time is to sing it while we're young. Once in every lifetime comes a love like this.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon. His new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, is a detective story that also rewrites history. It's based on this premise. What if the state of Israel collapsed in 1948, and a district in Alaska was set aside as a temporary Jewish homeland? The novel is set 60 years later, after conflicts have arisen between Jews and Native Alaskans, and there are divisions between secular and ultra-Orthodox Jews. You know, by getting into something that in some ways is like a parable of the Middle East, it's a kind of shadow version, an alternate version of the Middle East, and it's also a kind of parable about divisions between Jews, between secular and ultra-Orthodox. So are you prepared to enter into a world of controversy unlike anything that you've entered before?
No, I guess I'm not. I've had, you know, even with the essay that I referred to that I wrote many years ago about that phrase book, Say It in Yiddish, in the very confined world of Yiddishists and Yiddish scholars and lovers of Yiddish and enthusiasts of the Yiddish language, that essay caused some controversy, and I got a lot of people outraged. They were mad at me for various reasons that I seemed to be implying that Yiddish was a dead language, or that I was mocking the authors of that phrase book, who are very much respected and revered scholars. And so I stirred up a little hornet's nest with that essay. So I do have a sense that there's probably going to be people that are upset for one reason or another. And yeah, I've done a certain amount of worrying and fretting in advance about just what that might be. But on the other hand, I think I was definitely motivated by this spirit, at least to some degree, this spirit of there's a Yiddish phrase, afsaluchis, which kind of means spitefulness or sort of mischievous, perverse. Knowing, saying something that you know is going to annoy someone or irritate them. In the wake of writing that essay and exciting the outrage of some people, I definitely had a sense. Well, you know, if that made you angry, you know, just wait till you see the whole novel that I'm going to write now that's set in that place. I don't know why. There's like a little bit of a devil inside, I guess.
When you're creating like a whole fictional world. You know, that rewrites history. You have to make sure that you're consistent and that everything you create kind of adds up. So what kind of like map of the world did you have to create so that you knew, you know, did you actually have like a plan on the wall someplace with like a flow chart or a timetable that you could follow your own rules in this world that you created?
You bet. I mean, you know, I got into this business so that I could do that kind of thing. I mean, when I was a kid, it all for me, writing, creative writing, as you know, we called it in school back then, it all had to do with maps and charts and diagrams and chronicles. And, you know, I was really into Lord of the Rings and the whole kind of apparatus that Tolkien created around. I mean, in a way, the story in the case of Tolkien was just an excuse to invent the languages from his point of view and draw the maps and make the charts and the chronologies. And I had the sense from a very early age that maps and making maps and charts and chronicles was part of the writer's job. And I grew up in this town in Maryland, Columbia, Maryland, that was a planned community that was built in the suburbs between Baltimore and Washington, in the countryside between Baltimore and Washington back in the late 60s. And we moved there when Columbia itself, which is now a city of close to 100,000 people, existed almost entirely on paper as maps, as plans, as diagrams and charts and proposals and projections. And I sort of grew up in this place where the maps were translated into reality before my very eyes, where the houses would be built, you know, there would be a street proposed, they would come out with stakes and strings and stake it out, and then over the course of the next several months, the street would be laid, the pavement, the sidewalks, the houses would grow, and it would all sprout before my very eyes. It was this very powerful demonstration of how somebody's idea, somebody's map that they just make up, and they come up with all these names for streets and neighborhoods and so on, and then there it is. It's right before your very eyes. And in fact, the streets in the city of Columbia were named after the works of great American writers. So there's always this kind of intense connection for me. And so starting this novel, one of the pleasures that I looked forward to in doing it was that I would get to do that. I did draw maps for my own use. I did a number of them, and city maps and territorial maps, and I came up with a timeline of world history in the event that the state of Israel didn't come into existence, because it failed to come into existence in this world. And I had charts and all of the kind of stuff. The whole Tolkien apparatus is there, but I don't know. I just felt like it was all there for my benefit to make the book, hopefully the world within the book, seem real and feel real and be clear to the reader.
Michael Chabon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Michael Chabon's new novel is called The Yiddish Policeman's Union. Coming up, John Savage, the author of a new book about the prehistory of teen culture. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Savage, is best known for chronicling the development of punk rock in his book England's Dreaming. He's written extensively about pop culture. In his new book, Teenage, he traces the creation of youth culture and the idea of youth as a separate class with its own rituals, rights, and demands. He considers the book a prehistory of the teenager. It begins in 1875 and ends in 1945, the year after the word teenager becomes a common part of the American vocabulary. Music is an essential ingredient of what we've come to think of as youth culture. Savage says there are signs of young people having their own music in the early 20th century, but it's in the 1930s and 40s with swing that teenagers start to be identified with a particular style of music.
One of the great revelations to me in the book was researching and entering the world of swing, which I'd never really considered before. To me, it was the music of my parents' generation. And I was absolutely bowled over at how good it was. And I was also really struck by the descriptions of how popular it was and how it offered this kind of complete lifestyle. There was a whole language, and there was a whole way of speaking, there was a whole way of walking, there was a whole, you know, clothes, dancing. It really was, to me, one of the first really cohesive youth subcultures. But the interesting thing about all this, which goes back to your question, is the fact that none of the tunes that these people played actually talked about what it was to be young. They didn't say, I'm a teenager, I'm a jitterbugging teenager, or whatever. It was just, you know, standard stuff. They were just saying, you know, writing songs about dancing or writing songs about love. So you don't actually have this much evidence of a self-conscious, youthful musical culture really before the end of the Second World War.
So that really starts with rock and roll.
Well, I don't think so quite. I think that there's evidence of it in R&B, you know, post-war R&B. There's a great track by the blues guitarist T-Bone Walker called Bobby Socks Baby from 1946, which is one of the first tracks I've been able to find that actually references self-consciously references youth culture. And there are songs about wild, wild young men, but basically, yes, it starts with much more with the advent of rock and roll, with tracks like 17 by Boyd Bennett, and obviously then going to I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent by Frankie Lyman, and Sweet Little 16 by Chuck Berry, etc., etc. And that shows how the advent of rock and roll really triggered much more coherent kind of youth self-consciousness and youth marketing, indeed.
Now, you will always be associated with youth culture because you were one of the chief chroniclers of punk rock in the
yes.
in the 70s and 80s. And you know, you knew the bands, and you wrote about it in magazines and later in books. What did teen culture mean to you then?
Well, I was born in 1953, so I was very fortunate. The Beatles hit in the UK when I was 9, and that was it. And my entry point into all this was always music. I'm one of those people that I heard the piper at a very young age and I followed, and that was it. So I was very fortunate, really, to see the whole 60s thing as it happened. And then I just kept on following it. You know, I was glued to the television in those days and I just saw everything happen. You know, Tamla Motown, the Byrds, Bob Dylan, the whole of the British, you know, invasion period. And it was just wild. And it was the only culture I had, really, because I was brought up in the suburbs of West London. And my parents weren't, you know, they were busy, you know, having a life and making a living and doing what they had to do. They weren't particularly interested in areas of culture. My mother was very interested in books, but they weren't interested in music. So I had the field to myself, really. And so as I became an adolescent, it was really everything to me. That's the world into which I would retreat. And that actually shaped the way that I saw the world. So I very much found out about the world through popular culture, particularly music, at a very young age, and I continue to do so for quite a long time.
I mean, music is one of the ways that youth culture not only tries to differentiate itself from its parents, but from previous youth cultures. I guess every generation of teenagers has its own music. So when you were writing about punk rock, and you know, by the time the Sex Pistols come along, you're already in your 20s.
I was 23 in 1976, which is just within the teenage catchment, which ends in 24. And also, you know, in some ways I was a late developer because in my actual adolescent years, I was busy studying. You know, I was very academically, I was a high flyer academically. And I was always taking exams. And then in the holidays, when I wasn't at school, I'd be wandering around central London with a friend or two. So I never had that thing that a lot of people have in adolescence, which is hanging around in gangs and going to clubs and stuff and getting into trouble. And I needed to do that. And so punk provided me with that arena. And also, I just loved the music. It wasn't an intellectual decision, oh, I'm going to get involved with this youth culture. I heard The Call again. I heard the Ramones album and I went to see the Sex Pistols. And that was it. Bango, you know. And no thought about it. Just dive in.
Now, you changed your name from Sage to Savage.
That's right.
And I imagine you did that when you started writing about punk?
That's correct.
Tell us why you made the change. Now that you're an adult, how do you feel about having kept the name Savage, now that being Savage wouldn't be an important part of your professional personality?
Well, the immediate reason was that when I started writing about punk, I had actually had a day job. I was training to be a lawyer. And I would have got fired if they'd have found out what I was doing. And so I had to invent a pseudonym. And a friend of mine got my name wrong on the telephone in an interview he gave to a London paper. And so my name came out as John Savage. And I thought, oh, I like that. I'll keep that. And in retrospect, also, it's in the great tradition of pop transformation. You know, if you get involved with pop culture, you transform yourself. And you actually, a pseudonym is a very basic part of the process. I love having a pseudonym. It's great. Because, you know, I can put John Savage in a box and go home and be Jonathan Sage. And it's something that, you know, I'm totally used to now after 30 years. To be honest, I didn't really think about it.
So you never changed your name legally?
No, I would never do that. No. I mean, it's fun. It's supposed to be fun. It's pop, you know. It's the idea of changing your name. You think of all those Hollywood actors who changed their names and all the British pop stars who changed their names. You know, David Jones became David Bowie. So, and Savage was a great punk name. And, you know, I still have a bit of that about me. I can be Savage if I have to be.
As part of your research for this book, I think you talked to your father about what his teen culture was like. What are some of the things your father told you that you never knew about him?
Well, the great thing that my father said to me was that he was born in 1918. So when the war broke out in Europe, he was 21. And he had been convinced that there, 2 or 3 years before the war, that there's going to be a war with Hitler. So he joined the Territorial Army, which was like the reservists before the war. And he just knew there was going to be a war. And he had a very, very distinguished wartime career. He was involved in the Desert War in El Alamein, the Battle of El Alamein, and he won a Military Cross, which is quite a high honour in the UK. We were talking about all this, and in some ways it was the high spot of his life. And I think, knowing my father's character, I think it was very exciting for him, and actually it quite suited his personality. Even though he had to do very, very dangerous work, he was a sapper, an engineer, and he had to go and clear paths through the minefield, which is something that I just could not imagine. And he said to me that the war took six years out of his life, and then it took him another 6 years to get his life really back together again. Although he was working, although he was doing okay, he found the whole aftermath of the experience extremely difficult. And I think it marked him for the rest of his life. And I think one of the things that my generation has had to deal with and examine the damage that World War II did, not only really to Britain, I mean, I partly dealt with it in the book in Europe as well, is to examine the damage that was done in World War II, not to feel envy for the Golden Generation, but actually to try and unblock some of the emotions, some of the events that actually happened during that period.
Do you feel like you were personally shaped, or that your generation's culture in England was personally shaped by growing up in the aftermath of World War II?
I really do, Terry, yes, absolutely, absolutely centrally. If only on a physical level, during the punk period, for instance, I was working in the City of London in the financial district, and probably about a third of the City of London was still, vacant lots, were still bomb sites. And there was this particular flower that grew on the bomb site called Buddleia, which is a very sweet-smelling flower. And I remember just, acres and acres of bomb sites with this very sweet-smelling flower. It was a very bizarre juxtaposition. And I took some pictures of London at that period, and it just looks, they're black and white, and it just looks like a bomb site. It looks almost Dickensian Victorian in its squalor. So there's that physical aspect of it. And a lot of my heroes when I was younger, say like The Who or The Beatles or The Rolling Stones, for instance, were all actually born during the war. And, I think some of what they did was, in their music, was acting out the war damage. I really do. And that high volume and that violence that you hear in a lot of British music from that period, particularly in somebody like The Rolling Stones and The Who, The Beatles transmute it slightly, but it's still there. I was brought up in the suburbs, and the whole point about that was that it was almost like a tabula rasa. It was almost like an ideal environment where, nothing would happen, everything would be safe. And although I hated that when I was an adolescent, I now realise that was a very valid thing for my parents to do. It's perhaps one of the only things they could do, because they'd just been through this terrible experience. And, I still talk about it with my mother, who still lives in London. And, when the whole, bombings happened in London, I said to her, how do you feel about this? Are you worried? And she started telling me...
You're talking about the subway bombings?
Yeah, the subway bombings, yes. July 7, 77, yeah. And when this happened, I said, how do you feel about this? Are you worried? And she said, oh, no, I remember when, there was a buzz bomb on those V1s, which were these pilotless bombs which would fly over London. And then they'd suddenly cut out. And it was when they cut out, you knew that they were going to fall to the ground. And she said, I remember being in the garden at home when one of these things came over and it aimed straight for us. And then just at the minute, it veered away and, hit a garden two or three houses down. So she'd lived through all this stuff, and she was very sanguine about it. She just said, if my number's up, my number's up. I'm not going to be scared by these bastards.
My guest is John Savage. His new book is called Teenage, The Creation of Youth Culture. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guest is John Savage. He chronicled the history of punk rock in his book, England's Dreaming. His new book, Teenage, is about the creation of youth culture. I'm wondering if you have children and if your decision to or not to have children was affected at all by your kind of prolonged period of being immersed in youth culture and being identified with teen culture and all the kind of music rebellions that came along with that.
Well, Terry, I'm never going to have kids because I'm gay. So, you know, that's just not going to happen.
You can still adopt.
No. I think that for whatever reason, I knew early on that I wasn't going to have children. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, in a way, yes, absolutely dealing with this topic is, you know, one way of experiencing that whole facet of life. I mean, I do have to reiterate that, you know, I don't actually live like an adolescent in my life. I do live like an adult. So this is very much, to some extent, work for me. It's not something that I have as an... I do distinguish my own personal life from my professional life and the work that I do. It's very important for me to do that. And again, that's encoded in the difference between, you know, my real name and my pseudonym. Absolutely, I think, and I do find it very interesting that I can give insights to my friends who do have children. I'm staying with friends at the minute in New York who do have children. We talk about it a lot, adolescent children, in fact, just coming to the upper limit of adolescence. And we've talked about it a lot over the years, and I can sometimes offer insights, you know, because I've studied the whole thing so carefully and I have, you know, I'm abstracted from the situation. I'm not in the emotionally involved. And again, they tell me things that they do, and I spend time with, you know, their children. And so it's all very interesting. I feel perfectly happy about it.
Just curious, during the punk period, I don't know if you were out then or not, but did you feel that punk culture was on the whole open to people who were gay and out, that there was a place for that within punk?
That's a very good question. I think absolutely not. In fact, there were a lot of gay people involved with punk, both in the UK and in the US, and absolutely none of them were out. The only person who was out in the UK was a singer called Tom Robinson, who wasn't really punk, who was new wave, and these things really mattered then. And actually, he was very brave, and I really appreciate him now, but at the time, I absolutely hated his music, which was just very, I found very boring. So although punk was a movement of outcasts, which it was in the early stage, for some reason it was quite pure. It had a very Puritan aspect anyway. A lot of punks were not particularly involved with sex or said they weren't particularly involved with sex. And for some reason, I think probably as a reaction against the previous sort of glammed glitter rock generation, which was, you know, very much promoted bisexuality, I think there was a certain amount of homophobia and intolerance. You know, there's a song by the Sex Pistols called New York, where they talk about, you know, poor little faggot. And I never noticed it then. But, you know, now it really grates. And I didn't have much sense of my own gay identity at the time, even though, in fact, it was in extremely important to me. So that's something I've really thought about quite a lot in the intervening years.
So what was it like for you during that period when you're part of this culture and you're changing your name to John Savage and it's like, this is who I am, this is what I'm about, except a fundamental part of who you are and what you're about can't be included in this part of teen culture?
Yes, well, when people ask me about the punk period, it was obviously on one level incredibly exciting. On one level, it was... you know, the time that formed me, the time that enabled me to write, which is what I'd always wanted to do. And I suddenly, you know, I conceived of the idea. I had a real problem when I was studying for law and I had to do these exams and I hate it. And I thought, well, what do you want to do, Clever Clogs? You know, okay, it's all very well to say you hate this. What do you actually want to do? And I thought, well, I want to write. And then 6 months after thinking that and making that decision, I was doing it. And then I was able to do it for a national music newspaper called Sounds. And that was, you know, and we were reaching probably 500,000 kids every week. It was insane, the exposure that you got. So on one level, it was just fantastic. I was seeing all these incredible bands, incredible groups, performances, and I was in the swing of this thing, and I was writing, which is what I'd always wanted to do. And on another level, it was as though I was emotionally frozen. And in some ways, I was incredibly unhappy and incredibly frustrated. And also at that point, I was taking, you know, I was taking drugs like, you know, you did in rock and roll in that period, and that didn't help either. And so, you know, it wasn't that when people ask me about punk, I say, well, it was very exciting, but it wasn't a personally happy time.
Having completed this really large book on the creation of youth culture, would you ever now want to be a teenager again, or are you glad to be way beyond that?
I'm really happy to be way beyond it. Thank you, Terry. I'm really, really, really happy. I mean, I just think you have to be who you are, be where you are, not want to be somebody different. It's okay to want to be somebody different when you're young, when you can experiment. But when, you know, when you're 53, you've got to be pretty grounded. Otherwise, you've got serious problems. And I have no desire to be a teenager again. I think that would be, you know, beyond nature in a very, very dangerous way. And in fact, you know, this goes back to the book and the parables in the picture of Dorian Gray and in Peter Pan about eternal youth. It's disastrous. It's incredibly toxic. And within our culture in general, there's, you know, a lot of people trying to prolong their youth, you know, in disastrous ways. It just doesn't work. You know, the human body has finite limits.
Well, John Savage, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry, it was a pleasure.
John Savage is the author of the new book, Teenage, The Creation of Youth Culture. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
A teenage dream's so hard to beat. Every time she walks down the street, another girl in the neighborhood. When she was mine, she looks so good. I wanna hold her tight. Yeah, teenage kicks right through the night. I'm gonna call her on the telephone. Have her over cause I'm all alone. I need excitement, oh I need it bad. And it's the best I've ever had. I wanna hold her tight. Yeah, teenage kicks right through the night.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1961, an integrated group of civil rights activists rode by bus through the Deep South, challenging segregation. Pledged to nonviolence, they remained undeterred by firebombings, beatings, and imprisonment. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Raymond Arsenault about his book, Freedom Riders. It's just come out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.